My argument that, I partly make in some of the papers that I've published, but that I'm making strongly in my forthcoming book is that the challenge that countries like Nigeria, like other resource-rich economies face is not of a resource curse, but it is of economic diversification.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
There's considerable academic literature on the resource curse thesis, which aims to explain why resource-rich countries have not benefited from their oil and mineral resources. And this resource curse thesis within economics, political science, and sociology has numerous economic, political, social, and environmental dimensions. But in her work, my guest has often highlighted the inadequacies of this resource curse thesis, particularly in explaining dissatisfaction with the pace of economic development in her own country, Nigeria. Zainab Usman is a senior fellow and director of the Africa Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She has previously worked as a public sector specialist at the World Bank and is co-author of the book The Future of Work in Africa, Harnessing the Potential of Digital Technologies for All. She has also contributed to the World Bank's flagship report on rethinking power sector reforms in developing countries. Her forthcoming book, Economic Diversification in Nigeria, The Politics of Building a Post-Oil Economy, is set to be published later this year. Zainab and I discuss the politics of development in Nigeria, why a political economy approach and a political settlements framework is better than the resource curse thesis for understanding the political constraints to reforming Nigeria's oil sector, what African countries ought to prioritize on their path towards digital transformation, and the types of reforms required to address the continent's growing need for electricity. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Congrats on your new position, Zainab, as director of the Africa program at Carnegie, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with Nigeria, Zainab, the African continent's most populous country. And in many ways, this is a very fascinating country, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the kind of political upheavals Nigeria has experienced since independence in 1963, to all of the rich natural resources it possesses, the oil economy, the constant kind of transitions between civilian and military rule. And I noticed that maybe since 1998, after General Sani Abacha passed away, it seems that it's things, at least politics, appears to be a bit more settled now. So let me begin with a very broad question, Zainab. Mm-hmm. What do you think characterizes the politics of development or the current development discourse in Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation with over 200 million people? So how are things now at the moment in terms of politics and development?
That's a very complicated but a very important question. You know, as you rightly mentioned, Nigeria is it's a large country. It is the world's most populous black nation. It is the most populous country in Africa. Then since 2014, it has been Africa's largest economy. So in a sense, what happens in Nigeria reverberates across the African continent, but also around the world. Mm-hmm. And, for a long time, Nigeria struggled with its politics. It still struggles with it today. Having gone through over three decades of very volatile military rule, which ended in 1999. The country had an opportunity to embark on, in a sense, a national self-renewal economically and politically. And it is still on that journey. So that's kind of an important context to have at the back of our minds. Now, coming specifically to your question around politics and development in Nigeria, I would say a lot of those issues are also African issues, and they are in many ways reflective of the challenges that many developing countries grapple with. So within Nigeria itself, the discourse around development and how politics shapes that is largely informed by this need to build an economy beyond the country's vast hydrocarbons resources, crude oil and natural gas. And to summarize it, you know, this boils down to achieving economic diversification. You know, some would even say that among Nigerians, you know, when you say economic diversification, people start to roll their eyes, because every policymaker who comes into office, especially at the national level, at the federal level, would always promise to do things that will take the country closer to achieving that objective of economic diversification. But the country is still struggling with that. So let me leave it there. Yeah.
I've never visited Nigeria, but I've had the pleasure of interacting with Chief Obasanjo when he visited Oslo a couple of years ago. And this was actually in connection with one of his books, Making Africa Work. And I enjoyed discussing leadership and failed states with him, because in that book, Chief Obasanjo was talking really about how, you know, leaders must address all these huge expectations of their citizens, how it is important for Africa's leaders to grow their economies, create more jobs. And if we don't do this, there would be this looming demographic crisis. Mm. And so I thought it was quite fascinating coming from him, you know, given his military background. And of course, he later on became a civilian president. He was talking about how African countries must consolidate democracy, liberalize economies, invest in people, infrastructure, all of this. And if this is not done, the consequences can be disastrous. So I'm just wondering, you know, in terms of, say, Nigeria, as you were saying, for many actually countries on the African continent, is it this kind of feeling that one is disappointed with the political leadership, that that is where the problem is? Is the discourse focused exclusively around corruption? Is there too much of this kind of rhetoric on, oh, we have to combat corruption, do this, do that, but there's less operationalization in practice?
Yeah, so that's, again, another interesting question, right? It's I think it's a question that people indeed are grappling with right now, as to whether, you know, the challenges of development in many African countries really just boils down to leadership, you know, and the politics around that, or whether there are other dynamics at play, right? So on one hand, you have this focus on the quality of leadership, which of course is absolutely spot on. You know, the quality maybe compared to some other parts of the world, which had been able to make a more significant transition from poverty to prosperity, the quality of leadership in terms of being able to deliver public services to people, in terms of being able to increase the standards of living, the quality of life more generally, you know, increase the productivity of the economy and things like that, has been somewhat better than what we've seen in many African countries. Of course, this is not to overgeneralize, because you have, you know, certain outliers, you know, whether it's Botswana, for example, or, you know, or Mauritius and so on and so forth. So there is that, you know, the quality of leadership, the role of corruption. But on the other hand, there are people questioning whether there's just too much emphasis on just the leadership, or
right,
maybe the role of specific individuals, as opposed to looking at all these other structural, historical factors, right? So structural in the sense that you look at Africa's position in the global economy, right? You look at the history of colonialism. This is not to say that all of the continent's problems boil down to colonial rule, because certainly parts of Asia also experienced colonialism, but you know, some countries there have been able to make meaningful progress since independence. So, you know, some of these structural historical dynamics that don't often come up, you know, you look at the nature of trade relations between African countries and different parts of the world where African economies are still exporting primary commodities. And this is where the subject of a lot of my research comes in, you know, looking at resource-rich countries like Nigeria, like Angola, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, and so on and so forth, that are still predominantly exporting unprocessed natural commodities, which does very little to increase productivity in their own economies, to ensure that their economies grow, provide quality jobs, and, you know, increase the standard of living for the vast majority of people. So all I'm trying to say is, you know, increasingly you have these two kind of different perspectives as to the nature and the root of underdevelopment or development challenges in African economies.
I think that's a great point. You know, sometimes I feel there's excessive focus on the leadership question. There's always this one savior that's going to save the country and transform it very quickly. And that one perhaps sometimes within many of these countries underappreciates the importance of all of these systemic aspects, the reforms of major institutions that perhaps is required, but also, as you mentioned, the historical legacies of colonialism, etc. Let's move on to this resource curse aspect that I know that you've been writing about quite extensively, Zainab. And it is particularly interesting, of course, in the Nigerian context, because Nigeria's hugely important oil sector is well known all over the world for its size. It is, of course, Africa's largest oil producer, Nigeria. It also is a major global exporter of natural gas. And all of this, the oil sector, oil and gas, has huge potential, right? In terms of transforming Nigeria. But many would say it is also a very dysfunctional sector. And I notice, and I find this really interesting, that you argue in your work that much of this dysfunction, which has often been examined or explained in light of this resource curse argument, is actually not perhaps correct. Resource curse as in countries with an abundance of natural resources, such as fossil fuels, having less economic growth or worse development outcomes, perhaps even less democracy than countries with fewer natural resources. So you've argued, and I'd like you to kindly elaborate on this, why you consider the resource curse thesis to be an inadequate explanation that explains perhaps, you know, the kind of disappointment with what oil has done for Nigerian development.
So to answer that question, I think I'm going to explain my starting point for how I got engaged with this topic and this line of analysis and research. So my starting point is, you know, as the citizen of, you know, or as someone who is originally from an oil exporting country like Nigeria, that is rich in natural resources, in oil and gas in particular, but very poor in per capita income terms. So I started asking the question, why is this the case? Why have these resources not translated into rising incomes, into sustainable development? What efforts have been made within the country to achieve this objective of translating resources into development? What has worked? What has failed? And very importantly, does politics play any role in this situation? So doing that then led me to the vast resource curse literature, which I examined deeply, you know, throughout my doctorate. I was reading, there are so many books and papers.
Right.
On the resource curse, you know, and when I started initially, I also thought, okay, it's a challenge of the resource curse. But then, you know, I just had to change the way I was thinking about this topic, because I just got to the realization that actually the resource curse does not explain what I was seeing or what I saw in Nigeria. But very importantly, also, it does not really fully explain the experience of other developing countries, whether in Africa, whether in the Middle East and the Gulf Arab economies, or whether in Latin America or, you know, parts of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So my argument that, you know, I partly make in some of the papers that I've published, but that I'm making strongly in my forthcoming book, is that the challenge that countries like Nigeria, like other resource-rich economies face, is not of a resource curse, but it is of economic diversification. So, however, the problem is that within the last 2-3 decades, the thinking around the development challenges that this category of countries face has been completely dominated by this framework of the resource curse. And basically, the resource curse, what it is saying is that these countries are afflicted by this curse of natural resources that operates through economic mechanisms of, you know, the Dutch disease in particular, but also our socio-political mechanisms. So let me try to explain that a little bit before I get to why this is actually not a helpful framework. So starting with the economic mechanisms of the resource curse, the argument goes that, you know, these countries experience the symptoms of a Dutch disease, which leads to an appreciation, an artificial appreciation of their exchange rates, which then makes their productive sectors, they're called tradable sectors, like agriculture, like manufacturing, uncompetitive because of this artificially high rate of their currency. So they end up relying more on imports of commodities as opposed to producing, you know, the goods that they consume domestically. And the problem then is because foreign exchange is earned primarily through the exports of these natural resources, particularly oil. But then you have a global oil market that is highly volatile. The moment global oil prices collapse, the economy, the domestic economy goes into crisis. So the solutions proposed by, you know, the kind of Dutch disease diagnostic are countercyclical policies to manage volatility and to create a buffer for the local economy so that there will not be a balance of payments crisis, right? And that is useful. That is a very, very useful, I think, diagnostic, and it's a very useful set of policy solutions. Then the socio-political mechanism of the resource curse is that due to the high volume of rents or revenues generated by the resource sector, this increases the likelihood of corruption by policy elites,
mm-hmm,
and by other stakeholders. But very, very importantly, it also increases the likelihood of conflict, because suddenly everyone in society wants to have access to these resource revenues. So you find that, at least according to the arguments that have been put forward, resource-rich countries are more susceptible, not just to corruption, but to violent conflict. Then finally, there's another strand of it that also looks at how these resource revenues undermine democracy, focusing on the experience of the Gulf Arab monarchies, that these political elites in these countries use these resources to buy off or coerce the opposition. So all democratic forces, especially opposition elements, are crushed, and you have monarchies or autocratic political elites reigning supreme. So that's really kind of a very, very, very rough summary of a very large literature. Now, there's a lot that we've learned from this, and particularly the, you know, through the economic mechanisms of the so-called resource curse, I think there are many useful elements there. I think they've done a good job in framing the macroeconomic challenges that countries face and in proposing some useful solutions for countries to be able to protect against this global oil price volatility.
You know, I'm just reminded, of course, of my own country, Norway, which has been extremely rich in terms of having these oil resources. But what we've been good at is to actually administer the revenues in a pretty sensible way. So we have the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, you know, it's called the oil fund here. Mm-hmm. And ever since, you know, Norway started earning money from its offshore oil, the revenues, it's just, you know, goes into this bank, this account. We don't really spend it. And one of the wonderful things about the politics of these revenues in Norway has been this widespread political agreement that we are going to save for a rainy day, that we are just going to use a small percentage of the income, just the interest that we get from these revenues, that should supplement the budget. Of course, things are changing now because of COVID, etc. We're using much more than we had planned. But generally, there's been this caution that we are thinking about future generations, that we won't spend it all today. And so, you know, I think that has been quite interesting. And of course, Norway has tried to, in its aid projects, there's been this Oil for Development program, tried to impart some of the lessons to other countries, to other oil-rich countries, not always very successfully, but there's been this focus on institutional reform, you know, legislation, creating good administrative structures to govern these very rich oil sectors and other resource-rich sectors. So what I actually like in your work is this focus that you have on political settlements as a framework for better understanding some of the constraints, right, in reforming these sectors. So I was wondering whether you could elaborate on why you think political settlements offers a better analytical framework than this resource curse thesis, and whether you think that applies also pretty much not just for Nigeria, but also for other countries like Angola. And what do you think these countries should be doing to diversify their economies much more than they're doing currently?
Starting with the first question, with the resource curse thesis itself, as I mentioned, there are some good things there, right? The things that we've learned. However, and I like the fact that you provided this wonderful example of Norway. And indeed, Norway and the way Norway has been cast as a model has both been interesting, but also very unhelpful to many countries, right? And I've attended so many conferences in which very recently in the past, like 3 to 4 years, where people are questioning this Norway model, not questioning it because it is not good. It's good for Norway. I don't know if it's good for many countries, right? So the idea of a sovereign wealth fund, let's get to the details and then I'll, you know, pull out and try to explain how that reflects on, you know, the resource curse thesis itself.
Great.
The sovereign wealth fund as a way of saving the resource rents or resource revenues for a rainy day, that is useful, but people are starting to question whether that is what a low-income country in Africa or even in other parts of the world should be doing when they have needs today. So, you know, there is certainly a case to be made that you don't want to consume all of the resource, all of the revenues generated from this non-renewable resource, right? You don't want to deprive future generations of their own share of this asset, or you want to create an asset out of a non-renewable resource. That is a whole kind of framework or thinking that informs setting up a sovereign wealth fund. Now, for a country like Norway, which is already high income, it is already industrialized, that makes a lot of sense. For a lot of African countries that need infrastructure today, to increase their productivity, to be able to grow other sectors of the economy. That is very, very doubtful that a sovereign wealth fund should be the best way to manage their revenues. So that's the specific, and you know, there are papers coming out on this particular argument that I'm making. But what this means more broadly for, you know, the literature itself, for how this problem and the solution, how they've all been framed, is that they have focused on revenue management rather than economic diversification. And this boils down to the diagnosis of the problem itself, which is quite faulty, which then leads to policy solutions like a sovereign wealth fund, which are just insufficient to deal with the economic development challenges that these countries face. The reason why we have, you know, policy solutions that do not fully address a problem that was misdiagnosed to begin with is because largely it is the resource curse thesis that has informed this diagnostic and the solution proposed itself. And the issue is that with the resource curse thesis, it focuses on the resource itself. So it ascribes power to an object that is inanimate, really, you know, just by virtue of having an oil and gas endowments does not mean that you're certain to experience certain problems. Like, these things are not immutable. So there's a certain determinism that is associated with the resource curse thesis, that the moment you have natural resource endowments, you are going to face these problems because the problem is the resource itself, ignoring then the role of actors, whether as individual political elites, as organizations, as multinational companies, as social groups, or as countries in shaping outcomes. So that's the first issue there. And then the second issue is just there's very little emphasis on, you know, structural and systemic issues that would make these resources a problem. So structural and systemic issues in the domestic economy and also in the global economy. And in the domestic economy, these entail, you know, as I mentioned earlier, whether it's the history of state formation in that country, the social composition or social makeup of the country, is it highly diverse? Are there all these ethnic and religious issues? The extent to which there's private sector development, which would mean that maybe a country can be able to add value to these natural resources, or whether it is unable to add value and then it ends up in this trap of just exporting unprocessed commodities, the extent of technological advancements. We don't get any of that. You know, the resource curse thesis just says it's the natural resource itself that is the problem. And then at the transnational level, you know, I mentioned oil price volatility, but also just generally the global commodities markets, where demand for the natural resource comes from. And, you know, in the last two decades, many resource-rich countries were able to experience very high rates of economic growth, which was completely contrary to what the resource curse thesis predicted, that these countries are going to be or would be trapped in this low growth trajectory. But what we saw was that because China and to an extent India became huge consumers of oil, gas, and mineral resources, that helped to drive growth in these resource-rich countries in Africa and in other parts of the world. So then also the role of a country as a price taker for a commodity or a price maker. So a price maker is a country like Saudi Arabia, which by virtue of its, you know, volume of production of oil can be able to set global oil prices by increasing or reducing production. So things like that, right? And for that reason, we are unable, the resource curse thesis does not really explain variation among different resource-rich countries, you know, between the Gulf Arab monarchies, for example, which are still very much dependent on their oil and gas resources, but, you know, they have very, very high incomes, per capita incomes, low rates of poverty. They're not industrialized, but there's no poverty, or there's very, very little poverty, and they're not democracies. Or, you know, between that, those set of countries, and then the democracy, some of the resource-rich producing countries in Africa, which are democracies, but which have high rates of poverty, you know, are still not industrialized, have very low per capita incomes, or very, very importantly, the advanced industrial countries of today, including Norway, which is still a major oil producer, the United States, which is an oil producer and which used to be, for a long time, a major minerals producer, right? You know, California, for the most part, developed out of the gold rush of the 1800s, as Canada, right? Canada is a major mineral producing country, as is Australia. So you have all of these variations that the resource curse thesis does not explain, and it narrows the problem down to the commodity itself and then frames the solution as one of managing revenues as opposed to achieving economic diversification. The second part of the question is then, having identified all of these problems with the resource curse thesis, how do alternative analytical frameworks provide a better way of diagnosing the problem and proposing solutions? On this, you know, some of us are therefore arguing that we have to use a political economy lens. And on this front, the political settlements framework is useful. So what is the political settlements? It is both a concept, which is the distribution of power in society between elites and other social groups. It is also a framework of analysis. And I guess there are some, semantics here. Is it even a framework or is it an approach? Because different people are using it differently. So maybe it's more of an approach, and then you develop the framework the way you see it fit. So I, you know, without going to all of those details, I employ the political settlements framework in my analysis of Nigeria's challenges with its natural resources, with economic development, and with achieving economic diversification. And this is useful. This framework is useful because it helps us identify the powerful actors who make decisions, whether these actors are individuals, whether they are groups, whether they are elites, whether they are non-elites, whether they are organizations, whether they are companies. We're able to identify who does what. We're able to identify what their interests are with respect to certain economic and political issues. And by doing all of that, then we're able to get a better sense of their likelihood to be invested in, supportive or obstructive of specific policy solutions. And then the final aspect of, you know, this framework is then we're able to get a better sense of what policies are likely to be successfully implemented and which ones are likely to be thwarted or ineffective. So that's kind of how I use the political settlements framework in my analysis of Nigeria's challenges of economic development.
You're teaching me to ask actually shorter questions. So that's a good thing, Zainab. When you were talking about the benefits or the challenges of having a sovereign wealth fund, I agree with you that there is often the need to distribute resources, use the resources right away, use the incomes right away, because there is so much poverty. There's so much that needs to be developed in terms of infrastructure. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But the Norwegian experience, I'm not saying, and I agree with you that, of course, you know, you can't really always apply it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But what I think is particularly interesting, that I think few people realize this, that Norway wasn't very rich when it discovered oil. You know, it was okay in a European context. But what Norway did was to adopt a very cautious approach, that the revenue from the oil fund, it took, I think, almost a decade, if not more, before Norway really started making money and saving, et cetera, and being able to use it in its budget. So what the Norwegian story, however irrelevant it may be for other countries, what I think is particularly fascinating is that while it was cautious, it was being patient, it accumulated resources, and then in the long term, suddenly, you know, there was much more that could be used by whichever party was in power to supplement the budget. So it's this kind of caution. But I understand that that is not always going to be politically feasible in many other parts of the world, you know. So is it then a matter of using whatever is available in a sensible, in a proper, in an effective manner? And that is where I think a lot of people are interested in better understanding if it is not about leadership, if it is not about saving for a rainy day, if it is about using revenues now, what must take place for those revenues to be used in an effective manner? So is it the kind of nexus between political and business elites? Is it the big man syndrome? Is it electoral politics? Is it the lack of long-term planning? What would you like highlight as the key problem that explains why countries like Nigeria or Angola haven't really been able to use these revenues much more productively to improve the living standards of its people?
So I'm laughing a little because, I mean, if I had a very clear-cut answer to that, I think I would be very wealthy because I would just package it and, you know, sell it to all these countries as, you know, the one solution to all of their problems.
let's say there are several solutions or several diagnostic tools that we could apply. What would those be?
Yeah.
Is it something about the leadership at all, or is it about institutions?
So it's a whole bunch of things, right? You know, I feel like I'm dodging. It's almost like an arrow that I'm dodging. I'm avoiding being pinned into a corner to say what are those two, three things, right? So it really, really depends on, and I know this is usually the stereotypical way that, you know, any analyst or researcher would respond to such a complicated question, to say it's complicated. You know, it depends on the context, right? But it really does. And I say this because, you know, there's often this generalization, and I also do it sometimes. You know, you just fall into familiar habits of just generalizing on Africa, even resource-rich countries in Africa. But when you look closely, then a lot of those generalizations begin to fall flat and they collapse. So a country like Botswana, which is still grappling with the challenge of economic diversification, but it is a middle-income country in Africa. It has low rates of poverty. It has fairly high per capita incomes. I don't have the specific numbers off the top of my head. And it has managed its diamond sector, the resultant revenues, and its economy more broadly very well. It's had stable, predictable, and fairly effective leadership to the extent that when the Mo Ibrahim Annual Leadership Prize was set up in, I think it was it 2008 or so?
Yeah,
The inaugural prize was given to the former president of Botswana, Festus Mogae, for stellar leadership. So all of those explanations that are usually invoked to explain why Africa, why resource-rich countries in Africa specifically struggle, you know, they just don't seem to apply to a country like Botswana, which is, for all intents and purposes, an African country.
And a very successful democracy.
A very successful democracy. So whether it's, you know, the corruption argument or the democracy argument or, you know, the leadership argument, the just don't really neatly explain what has happened in Botswana or what's even happening in Ghana right now. Ghana has also done some interesting things, right? It has been able to achieve significant levels of poverty reduction over the past two decades. And it's a successful democracy, right? Without the staggering levels of corruption that you would find in other parts of the continent, including my own home country like Nigeria. So this I'm trying to explain is why I've been kind of dodging
the arrow,
exactly. Having said that, though, I would say that quite a number of those explanations that are put forward, they apply to an extent in different ways. So, of course, there's still the problem of corruption. In Nigeria, corruption is a major, major problem. And I'm aware that there's this huge literature that tries to argue that, you know, corruption is often not the major problem in many developing countries, which is true. But then a lot of those papers or those studies, you find that they do this typology of, you know, corruption that can enhance growth and then corruption that is obstructive to growth. And Nigeria is always, always the country that they use as a case study of harmful types of corruption, whether it's Atul Kohli doing that analysis or Yuen Yuen Ang, all of them.
All my right? guests. And Mushtaq Khan.
And Mushtaq Khan, by the way, you know. So there is, you know, we cannot deny the fact that in Nigeria, corruption is a problem, but it is not the only problem. So what then? What then is the main problem? I would say if there's anything that explains or that helps to explain why certain countries succeed on this front in economic diversification, in achieving economic development, in reducing poverty, in better management of their natural resources, is really having a clear vision of what they want to achieve and being and consistently implementing or making progress on achieving that vision.
Zainab, let's talk about one concrete area, an area that you've done considerable work on, and that has to do with addressing Africa's growing energy needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that interests me, and every time I travel to Malawi or Kenya or Tanzania or wherever, there's always this longing for more electricity. One aspect, of course, has to do with power generation, that there's inadequate power. And then another aspect has to do with making whatever is available more effective, that it has to do with increasing the grid, getting more people connected, making sure that the pricing is right, all of these aspects. So, this is a topic that is becoming more and more relevant in terms of, say, sustainable development, achieving the sustainable development goals. And we have all of these actors coming in. And you mentioned China right in the beginning of our conversation. Chinese companies are building hydroelectric power projects, but there are solar power plants, also coal-fired power plants. So all of this is going on. And I've been studying it in Malawi and also in Kenya. And there are all kinds of protests, etc. But the fundamental issue still appears to me that there is just not enough power being generated. So that's one aspect. And then there are all of these other distribution aspects. So what would you say if you were to apply this political settlements framework in trying to come up with not necessarily solutions, but just a way forward? You know, how can one address this growing need that the African continent has for energy?
So starting with the energy needs, as you rightly mentioned, this is something that many African countries are grappling with. And unfortunately, the African continent, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, is turning out to be the world's most energy poor region. So in terms of, the number of people lacking access to electricity, more than 70% of them right now are in sub-Saharan Africa. The unfortunate thing is the vast majority of people living in energy poverty used to be in Asia, but because many Asian countries, including India, have made so much progress in achieving, in providing universal electricity access, the center of energy poverty is moving to Africa. And then, you know, we ask the question, why does this matter? Is this just an issue of people connecting bulbs and, you know, having electricity to charge their phones and to conduct small businesses, or is there something else? It's all of those things and something else, which is the topic we started this discussion with. Economic diversification and economic development cannot be achieved without universal access to affordable and reliable electricity in African countries. And again, you know, there's work emerging on this front. I feel like for a long time, these links were not clearly made between why it is important to have electricity access and how that links to economic development objectives. It was always clear, I think, to policymakers, but in the policy community, somehow we forgot, in a sense. So this is now being placed front and center on the agenda for many countries. And, you know, one final thing I'll say to really hit home the point that electricity access, affordable and reliable electricity access, is so crucial to economic diversification and achieving economic development in African countries, is that it is really linked tangibly to the productivity of firms, of enterprises, of small businesses that dot the African landscape. And it is these firms and small businesses that will create quality jobs of tomorrow, and in which actually a lot of Africans are engaged in today, in these low-wage, low-productive jobs. You find that lack of reliable electricity is usually one of the top three issues that comes up in most enterprise surveys that are conducted across the African continent.
That's correct.
Yes. So this is so important, and this is why it matters. Now, what can be done? And does the political settlements analysis help us to figure out what can be done? To an extent, yes. But let me just focus on what can be done and how it can be done differently from previous approaches that have failed. So when I was at the World Bank, we worked on this big study that examined across a two-decade period, actually a three-decade period, the experience of developing countries with power sector reforms. And we did the study to really examine, you know, even some of the advice and support that the World Bank had provided to these countries to reform their power sectors, and then to think of what has worked, what hasn't worked that well, and how things can be done differently. So what we found was that, and you know, this study is available online. It's called Rethinking Power Sector Reforms in the Developing World.
I'll link it in the show notes.
Yes, so it's there. And then there are the background papers also. I wrote about two background papers, as well as the contributed to the main report. So we found a couple of things. First is that these reforms, we called them standard model of reforms, that were, you know, they were conceptualized based on this Washington consensus orientation to policy making. These reforms, they focused more on processes rather than outcomes. So they focused more on processes in terms of what countries need to do to be able to overhaul their power sectors. So these reforms focused on liberalization, privatization of the utility in a particular country, introducing competition to the sector, and then also establishing a regulator. Whereas countries that seemed to make significant progress actually did not always fully implement all of these power sector reforms with these four elements that I just mentioned. They selected what they felt worked for them. For example, they would unbundle maybe generation from transmission and distribution, and then they would introduce private sector participation in generation, in the establishment of power plants, but then transmission and distribution would still be largely state-oriented, with the state-owned power utility playing a key role.
But this is good, right? Because it demonstrates some sort of ownership that you don't want to just simply follow some prescription, but you're making your own choices.
Yes, absolutely. So those are, you know, countries, a country like Morocco, that was exactly what it did. And then, you know, in these countries also, you find that they put specific socioeconomic objectives at the core of these reforms, as opposed to focusing just on the processes, which is why then they flip it, right? They ensure that the processes are meant to achieve these socioeconomic objectives. Therefore, they're very selective as to what they implement. And these socioeconomic objectives are, you know, achieving universal electricity access. This is something that Morocco was able to do successfully from, you know, the 1990s to date. It has nearly 100% electrification. I think as of 2 years ago, it was at 98% or something like that. And then also environmental sustainability, putting that at the core of, you know, reforms. So ensuring that you put these socioeconomic objectives at the core of whatever you do, I think is probably a recipe that takes you closer to success, rather than just focusing on processes and how your power sector should look like, is what I would say. In terms of using the political settlements analysis, so the work that I've done, we used the political economy approach without necessarily using political settlements in particular, I would say. But through this approach of using just political economy more broadly, you know, again, identifying the actors, what their interests are, how their interests align with specific policy solutions, and then, of course, the likelihood of the implementation of these policies, whether the policies end up being successful or unsuccessful. You know, we use some of that analysis or some of that approach in the analysis of Morocco's experience with power sector reforms, for example, to understand why it was able to succeed on these socioeconomic objectives and why it did not completely implement all of these reform prescriptions compared to other countries that did that.
A final set of issues, Zainab.
Yeah.
And that has to do with digital technology and the kind of potential that that holds for many countries around the world. And, you know, it's not just for African countries. There's been this fascinating development in terms of how we are using digital tools since last year, even in Norway, the United States, all of these developed countries. And the very fact that you and I are talking and that I started my podcast, and it doesn't matter that people are not here in person, we can communicate. We are all working from home. But this is not something that is always possible for all groups of people. And I know that you've been working on this. And so if you could kindly reflect towards the end of this conversation, and by the way, we can go on and on. There's just so much to talk about. But how do you think this kind of digital technology adoption, how can it be harnessed more effectively? How can it transform the nature of work for African citizens? So, you know, what should one be doing? What are the first sort of steps that governments ought to take now that everybody recognizes that digital technology is important and can be a crucial tool in the near future?
So before I answer that, Dan, I just realized I didn't answer the China question. Do you want me to do that quickly?
Okay.
Yeah, and then we can come back to this,
sure.
Right, to conclude. So the role of China in energy in Africa is, of course, a very, very interesting one. But also importantly, its role is evolving in that space. So to begin with, as you're aware, China is now Africa's probably most important bilateral economic partner in terms
That's
of
correct.
Trade, in terms of investments, but also in terms of what is called aid, or what I prefer to call development assistance. This has been the case for like two decades at least. And for some parts of Africa, particularly I would say parts of maybe East Africa and so on, China has been engaged for, you know, more than four decades. But I think under the Trump administration in particular, and then with the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, there was suddenly a realization that, you know, China is now an important global power and is playing this interesting, dynamic, and pivotal role in many parts of the world, including in Africa, which is why everybody now is suddenly interested in the role of China in Africa. But what I'm trying to say is this has been an engagement that has been on for decades. And in infrastructure in particular, that is proven to be China's core strength in infrastructure investments, in infrastructure projects. So in energy, China is a major investor in energy generation, in hydropower projects in particular. So one study I came across shows that China accounts for about 60% of hydropower investments in sub-Saharan Africa. And this is largely because China does very big grand projects, right? Then the other dimension is that China, for the past two decades at least, has been a major importer of oil from African countries. Although African countries are not the major suppliers of oil to China, a lot of that comes from the Middle East and also, I think, Brazil, and also China's own domestic oil production, actually. But for certain countries, Angola specifically, and, you know, to an extent, Sudan, at least before the, you know, before the partition, were major suppliers of oil to China. And with Angola in particular, China and the country were able to come up with this interesting model of resource-backed loans or resource, no, no, not resource-backed, resource for infrastructure deals, mm-hmm. where they import the oil, but rather than actually pay, they pay in terms of infrastructure projects, right? And this is such a controversial arrangement that has drawn a lot of, you know, praise in some quarters, condemnation in other quarters, but just it has drawn a lot of interest. And this resource for infrastructure model is also being used right now in Ghana. So it's a very, very interesting space on that front. And the final thing I want to mention in terms of China's involvement in energy in Africa is that when it comes to the energy transition, green energy, China could end up being an important player in Africa, because in terms of building renewable energy generation infrastructure, for example, China could be an important player on that front. It has, you know, it has a large market share of solar energy hardware globally. A lot of solar energy components are manufactured in China. So it has the expertise on that front. But also, it could be a major provider of financing going forward in the future. But this is an area that is still evolving. And I think if there are any young researchers looking for research topics, this is an area that I would encourage them to really look at. There's a lot is going to happen in that space. So with digital technologies, they do provide significant opportunities for African countries to address their economic development challenges, right, that we've mentioned, whether it's framing this in terms of economic diversification, in terms of increasing incomes, in terms of generating jobs. And with the latter is an area where we've done some work. You know, we published a book when I was at the World Bank. So the opportunities that it provides are at least twofold. The first is with, you know, increasing digitization of the production process, or the adoption of digitization in production and manufacturing in, you know, higher income regions of the world, there could be an opportunity for African countries to capture manufacturing foreign direct investment. This is called flying geese, right? The flying geese model, where low wage manufacturing could move from Asia in particular to African countries. But this is not guaranteed, right? And people are making the argument that there's a very narrow window for which to capture this low-wage manufacturing, that African countries would need to improve the business environment, put in place the right infrastructure, connectivity infrastructure, energy, transport, et cetera, and increase the skills base of the population. So that's one, right, in terms of how, you know, digitization could help provide opportunities for African countries. Another way is that it could provide new opportunities in terms of new industries that could emerge due to the application of digital technology. So fintech, you know, is one area that is very, very evident. Financial services, and you find that African countries are actually quite advanced compared to other parts of the world in areas like, you know, what do you call it, the mobile money accounts, for example.
Right, especially Kenya.
Especially Kenya, exactly, with M-Pesa. But the problem is a lot of these innovations or these positive stories we're hearing emerging out of parts of the continent are still in pockets, in a sense. We want a situation where they're scaled up across, you know, vast parts of the continent. So for that to happen, you know, countries through the government, but through other stakeholders will have to invest in the analog complements to digital technologies. And these are, you know, the obvious things: connectivity, infrastructure, energy and transportation. This is, you know, we mentioned this in the book. They need to invest in human capital. Specifically, they need to ensure that, you know, they overhaul their education systems. They're able to provide opportunities for those who could be potential inventors and innovators who could create new opportunities for others. They need to increase the productivity of micro, small, and medium-scale enterprises that dot the continent, in which many people tend to be engaged in for work, for employment, and they need to provide social protection to particularly young people, particularly the small businesses, to help them make, you know, the transitions that they need to make in this new economy, in a sense.
Zainab, it was great fun to speak with you today. Thanks so much for coming on my show.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.